both MacArray and the Predominance setup.
I'm Patrick McConnell, just here for kind of logistics support as well as interest. Just some logistical things. So we have kind of, I mean, we keep the agenda pretty open. Basically, we'll be letting you know, Dr. Simon, you know, run things and let you guys sort of you know, do whatever you guys want as far as material and things like that. We'll have lunch at noon, and then a break again at 3. The bathrooms are straight out here to the, and go down the hall to the left. You can see them on your left. There's a across the hall, soda machines and things like that. We'll have sodas at lunchtime. There's some waters here and paper pad. We've got a couple printouts as far as, I guess, this agenda, which is pretty open. Just some background information on the pre-conference seminar. And then also a little questionnaire that you guys can fill out towards the end of the day. And we have that just to provide some feedback. Otherwise, I guess I'll just leave it to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Patrick. I guess the structure was to have 2 hours before lunch, and then lunch for an hour, and then 2 hours after lunch, and then I think an hour for questions. But I'd like to rule on it just more informally. So at any time, if you have questions, just raise your hand, and we'll discuss it at that point. My intent was really to try to focus this, and I don't know how clear it was from the title, but to focus it on using microarrays for what I'll call class prediction or survival risk prediction. And we'll talk about the different sort of uses of microarrays. But I did not intend this to be sort of a very first introduction to microarrays, and I think that would be that's appropriate because it sounds like most of you have some knowledge of microarrays. I do want to call your attention to this website. This is my website, my branch, and in that website there's I will put the PowerPoint slide, the PowerPoint file from, you know, that I'm showing you today, of which you have, I guess, the hard copies of on your handout. So the PowerPoint will be there, and I'm actually trying to make a recording of this with my handy little digital voice recorder. And if that works, then I'll put that file also there. So you just go to that website, and you'll see a thing that says technical reports and talks. And it has a lot of PDF files of reprints of publications related, mostly related to microarray kinds of things, and also some bunch of PowerPoint files. There's also other stuff on that website. My BRB Array Tools software is there, and we've also created a couple of new things. One sort of a data archive in which we've taken some published microarray data from cancer, for clinical data from patients' expression profiles of that have been published with regard to cancer patient data from mostly prominent publications, and we've sort of put that data in BRB Array Tools format with the clinical data that was included, that was made available by the authors of the publications. And we have probably about 20, 25 data sets there. And it's really to give, in the future we hope to give people who use BRB Array Tools a way of archiving their data, an easy way of archiving their data. It also gives a way of reanalyzing other people's data without sort of having to fiddle around with their format, because it's all, we've already put it in BRB Array Tools format. And so we're also going to be developing some tools for BRB Array Tools that do sort of cross data set comparison kind of things. And so it'll make it easy to do that. And we have some other things on the website, like sample size planning for clinical trials, for targeted clinical trials. I won't go into that today.
Can you talk a little bit more about the cross data comparison? Because that's something I'm actually.
Well, we don't have any tools in. I mean, in BRBRA tools, it's sort of microarray data analysis software. Some of you may have used it, and some of you maybe haven't. And it's mostly. It's sort of really. We put a lot of effort into it, and I think a lot of it is basically state-of-the-art tools. And most everything I will talk about today, all the analysis methods are available in BRBRA tools. But we haven't put anything into it about cross-data set analyses. And so I think we want to do things like if one study comes up with an expression profile that distinguishes the responders to some, you know, the good prognosis from the poor prognosis patients, and you want to try, and we would like to build a tool that would take that expression profile from that study, automatically find, and sort of apply it to the data from another study. So that would mean the other study may not have used the same array platform. And so one of the things it means is finding the subset of genes that are sort of represented in the two studies. And then the question is, well, what do you mean represented? That they used this, just that they corresponded to the same genes, or that they corresponded, that there's some overlap of the parts of those genes that are that the oligos are recognizing, or what? So we'd have to do that, or you could just do it in the simplest way and say you have gene symbols for the arrays here, for the profile here, and gene symbols on this array, and we just sort of match it by gene symbols, and then basically to try to apply that. So that would be, I guess, one sort of kind of approach. We really haven't sketched out all of the things.
We experience a lot of the data set variability. Say if you have one data set, you make a model, then you try to predict another data set, then the two different data sets, actually, if you do the PCR analysis, you will see that it's just separate. So you have to remove this variability. Currently, we are using the DWD method.
What do you mean that? When you say the variability, what do you mean?
So simply do the PCR analysis for the two experiments, the data set. Then you will see the each data set will group together. So you build the model on based on one data set, try to predict another data set. Sometimes there's some bias there, so you have to remove this variability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any better methods?
Well, I don't know that. I don't want to go into the. We got a lot to cover, so I don't really want to sort of just. But yeah, and I can't really tell you. Yeah, you're right in terms of doing cross-study tools, there would be issues like that. In other words, a lot of times if you build a predictor from one data set, then because there's some, you know, there just may be some systematic differences that you would have to sort of calibrate before you predict to another one. Anyway, I've just included, I think, two slides here of related kinds of publications, just so you'll have those citations. And many of the PDF reprints are on that website. Okay. Start off with the issue is. There is, I think, a myth that microarray investigations should be just unstructured data mining adventures without clear objectives. And I think that's not right. Good microarray studies have clear objectives, but they're not gene-specific mechanistic hypotheses. I think a lot of times in biology, certainly what people really want to, you know, traditionally have are gene-specific mechanistic hypotheses, and traditionally that's because assays were one gene or one protein assays. And now with microarrays, you can start looking at things, and you have an assay that gives you some information about a lot of different genes or a lot of different genes, and so that changes somewhat the nature of the kinds of questions you can ask. But I think you still need to have a pretty clear objective of what you're setting out to do, because I think your objective of what you're setting out to do really determines in large part what kind of specimens you need from what kind of patients, and it also actually determines what kind of analysis methods and analysis tools you should be using. And I think in microarray kinds of studies, there's a lot of using the wrong tool for the wrong question. And we'll talk about that a little bit. So I like to distinguish three general kinds of objectives, and they're not all-inclusive, but many kinds of things people are doing fit into one of these three categories. One has been called class comparison, and it's basically gene finding. It's finding the genes that distinguish diseased tissue from normal tissue, or finding the genes that distinguish the good prognosis patients from the poor prognosis patients, or finding the genes that distinguish that if you say withhold the blood supply from the kidney of a mouse, and then do expression profiles before you do that and expression profiles after you do that, find the genes that get turned on or get turned off as a function of that intervention, where you're doing an intervention in some model system to try to understand biological mechanisms. Class comparison, I think of as basically gene finding. Sometimes it's not classes being compared, you know, but you can do gene finding with find the genes that are related, that are sort of correlated with survival. And that's gene finding. It's sort of like class comparison, except unless you're going to sort of group your survival data into long versus short or something like that, you don't have discrete classes. Then there's something that I call class prediction. And I think when these terms were originally developed, I think by Todd Golub, he didn't distinguish, I don't think, class comparison from class prediction. But I think they should be distinguished, because I think those two kinds, they're two very different objectives, and I think the methods you use should be different. Class prediction is where you want to be able to say you have some patients who are good responders to a certain kind of treatment and patients who are bad responders, who don't respond, and you want to develop some kind of a mathematical function or some kind of an algorithm that will permit you, given the expression profile of the patient in the future, to be able to predict, is this patient likely to respond to this particular treatment or not? And so if you really want to be able to predict, it's not just a matter of, well, what genes distinguish the responders from the non-responders. It's just giving a list of genes that distinguish the responders from the non-responders doesn't tell you what your prediction is. So if your objective is really to predict, you need to come up with what I call a classifier, but the word classification is really ambiguous, because some people think of classification as something other than that. But you need to come up with an explicit predictor. And it's not enough to say, well, I'm going to cluster my data and see if the responders are different than the non-responders. Well, how is that a predictor? So if I give you an expression profile, we'll find in the future, how are you going to predict whether that the expression profile, the patient who gave the specimen for which you got that expression profile is likely to be a responder or non-responder. So class prediction is about having explicit predictors that we can use in the future to make predictions. And actually, mostly what I'm going to talk about today is class prediction, or sort of something related to that is survival risk group prediction, where you have some time to event data like survival or like time to disease progression, and you want to be able to predict for the future patients whether they're likely to have a long time till that event or a short time to that event, to predict their risk group and do it in a way without necessarily grouping the, say, survival data into discrete classes. Now, this, and as we'll talk about, in developing class predictors, one step of the process is selecting the genes that are informative for the kinds of prediction you want to make. But that's only one part of it. And actually, the criteria for selecting, the criteria for gene selection for class prediction is not necessarily should not necessarily be the same as the criteria for gene selection for class comparison. And we'll get into why that is. And the third sort of grouping here is class discovery. And that's where we either want to group together the specimens based on their having very similar expression profiles across all of the genes, or group together groups of genes that are very similar with regard to their expression levels across all of the specimens. And the idea with with these clustering approaches, either clustering the specimens or clustering the genes, the idea here is we're clustering them without, just in terms of expression data. We're not talking about, well, who's normal, who's diseased, who's a good responder, who's a bad responder. So these clustering methods are called unsupervised, as opposed to class comparison or class prediction is thought of as being supervised, and all that the supervised means is that you're using some information other than the expression profiles to drive your analysis.
So the expression profiles are not necessarily a disease state or a non-disease state? I guess I'm asking for further clarification on the term expression.
Well, by the expression profile, all I mean is what we get from the microarray is we get something like a level of intensity of fluorescence for a given gene on a given array. And what we did, let's think of it for simplicity, let's think, and I'll go into a little bit about the different kinds of platforms, but for the simplicity, let's think of where our platform is just a single label platform, like an Affymetrix platform. We take a sample of tissue from some individual, we extract the RNA, we label it with a fluorescent label, we label the and then we put it down on an array, and then essentially we measure the amount of fluorescence at each spot on the array corresponding to all of our different genes. And so what we get then, if we have, say, 20,000 genes represented on that array, what we get is sort of a level of fluorescence for that particular specimen for each of those 20,000 genes, and we hope that the that those levels of fluorescence have something to do with the amount of RNA, the amount of messenger RNA for that gene in that collection of cells that we did the extraction for. So I'm using the term expression profile only to mean those 20,000 numbers, not mean anything more meaningful than that. I'm just using expression profile in sort of a very generic, straightforward sense. Yeah, I tend to use the word signature in a vague sense, where signature is something you get after doing your analysis, that somehow represents some biological state. And I guess I'm using the term expression profile to mean just the raw data, sort of. So usually for class comparison, find the genes that are differentially expressed between normal and disease. So to do that, you have to take into account in your analysis, well, which of these arrays corresponded to individuals who were normal, and which of these arrays did I use specimens from individuals who had the disease, and similarly for class prediction. So those are supervised, and those analyses are supervised by that information. They're driven by that information, whereas class discovery is just find the sort of clustering the genes to put together genes that have similar expression numbers across the samples, or cluster the samples, the specimens, to put together those that are similar with regard to their expression profiles without driving it by any. A lot of times what you actually see is people have class prediction problems, and somehow they wind up using cluster analysis for it. Usually it's done in one of two sort of ways. Either they do the cluster analysis of the samples without taking, say you're trying to predict responder from non-responder, they do a cluster analysis of the samples without just sort of using all the genes. And then after they get what they think are their clusters, they try to say, well, this cluster actually, does this cluster have more samples in it from the responders than this cluster? And if you have problems where the two classes you're trying to distinguish, responders and non-responders, are really grossly different with regard to lots and lots of genes, usually that won't be the case with regard to response to treatment. But if you're comparing expression data from lymphocytes to expression data from granulocytes, yeah, there's going to be lots of genes that are differentially expressed between those two classes, because those are two totally different cell types. So a lot of these problems are actually sort of toy problems. And clustering, if you just cluster the samples with regard to expression profiles of all of the genes, you will wind up with clusters in which one cell type is mostly constituted in this cluster and the other cell type is mostly constituted in the other cluster. But if you try that approach on real problems where maybe you have 100 genes that are differentially expressed between, say, responders and non-responders out of the 20,000 you're assaying, and if you just have your cluster analysis, see, cluster analysis, you know, if you use all 20,000 genes for driving that cluster analysis, for the most part, you won't see clusters that one of which is dominated by responders and the other which is dominated by non-responders, because the information in those 100 genes get swamped out by the 19,900 noise genes that are not differentially expressed between the responders and non-responders. So, in general, cluster analysis is not a very good approach for class prediction problems. Now, the other thing, the way some people do it is they sort of use some combination. They actually use class comparison methods to find the genes that are differentially expressed between responders and non-responders, and then they cluster the data, they cluster the samples using only those, say, 100 genes that were found to be differentially expressed. That's very widely used, but that's actually also not a good approach, because the fact that your clusters may differ, you're using the same data. Well, as we talk about class prediction, we'll spend a lot of time talking about that. There's sort of two aspects of class predictors. One is sort of the machinery and the techniques for coming up with class predictors. And the second is, how do you evaluate how good those class predictors are? We're going to talk about both of those things. Those are the two things we're going to spend most of our time on. But when we talk about how you evaluate a class predictor, the cardinal principle is going to be the data you use for developing your predictor has to be different than the data you use for evaluating your predictor. And if you do this sort of thing that I just say, you use all your data to develop, to find the genes that are differentially expressed between your responders and non-responders, and then you cluster all your data with regard to those genes, you've violated that principle. You've used the same data to essentially build your classifier, that is, to find those differentially expressed genes, and now you've clustered your data with regard to those genes, and now you claim, because you have in those clusters, you have more responders in one and more non-responders in the other, you want to claim that you actually have something. But the problem is you've sort of violated this fundamental principle, and so it's not, it has other problems in that you don't actually have a real predictor that you can use for the future, but it also is sort of a spurious way of trying to claim that there's a difference between responders and non-responders. And so doing a cluster analysis of genes that were pre-selected to differentially expressed is not even an independent way of showing that genes are, that the two classes are differentially expressed. In fact, if you have 20,000 genes, suppose you have two classes, and in fact, suppose there's no difference between these two classes with regard to the expression, the real expression distribution of any of the genes. Well, what you do for your class comparison is I'm going to do a t-test gene by gene for each one of these 20,000 genes, and I'm going to declare that gene to be differentially expressed if the p-value for my t-test is less than 0.01. Well, okay, how many false positive genes do you expect? Well, it's 0.01 times 20,000. Because 0.01 is sort of the probability of getting a false positive from any one of those t-tests. And if you do a t-test for 20,000 genes, it turns out that the expected number of false positives is 20,000 times 0.01, even if the genes are correlated. So 20,000 times 0.01 is 200. So you will wind up with about 200 genes that you claim are differentially expressed. And if you actually then cluster your samples with regard to those 200 genes, I wasn't really planning on talking about what does it mean to methods of cluster analysis. But if you cluster your samples with regard to just using the information from those 200 genes, you will find clusters, one of which contains most of the responders and the other of which contains most of the non-responders. But those clusters were really just driven by the false positives. So that whole, the whole procedure, if you really have a problem involving responders and non-responders or tumors and normal, or generally cluster analysis is not really what you want to be doing. We will talk a lot about what it is you do want to be doing. Well, so I'm just saying it's not a clustering problem. The other thing is that clustering doesn't really control this multiplicity issue of how many false positives you want to limit to. So we want to be using supervised methods. And the other thing is, if we want to say something about how do tumor tissue differ from normal tissue, how does tumor tissue, what genes are differentially expressed, say, in tumor or disease tissue versus normal, or whatever our classes are, we're talking about normal tissue. We must be talking about some particular organ, and disease tissue of that same organ. But the point I want to make here is that what we don't want to be doing is comparing the array of one array here to one array here, because we want our conclusions to be more just that, to not be limited to the fact that our expression data for this array or for this sample is different than for that sample. Now, a lot of times, and so in order to make conclusions that have to do with tissues of this type or patients of this type, we need to study multiple tissues or patients of this type. And if we're contrasting it to tissues or patients of that type, we need to study multiple things of that type so that we understand the variability, so that we can say that the difference between this is greater than the variability within each of those two groups that would occur. And so a lot of times we may start out with a study in which we have one of these and one of those, and we want to see, well, is there anything, does it look like there's anything there that we want to do a bigger study on? That may be okay for starting out with. But you probably want to ultimately have multiple. And, yeah?
Before we move on to the next slide, I would like to follow up with your point in doing clustering after you have done the t-test.
Yeah.
Now, a t-test is kind of a univariate analysis. You pick up genes one by one, mm-hmm. okay? And say if you pick up certain number of genes by this method, and later on your cluster is based on a distance measurement, you calculate the distance of all the genes you pick up and the cluster them together. Now, mathematically, can you prove that if you do it this way, it must cluster? Is that true or not?
I've done simulations,
uh-huh.
Where we just do a simulation, we take. I've had a guest visitor from. We put a couple of these simulation results in a paper that is not published yet. Simulation result. You don't have to do lots of simulations. You know, lots of replications. Just take one replication of a simulation where basically you just assume that you have two classes and you have 1,000 genes or whatever, and 10,000 genes, and you just generate your expression data from whatever the distribution is, say normal, mean zero, variance one. It's the same for both classes, and it's the same for both classes for every gene. And just generate data for all your genes in this class and for all your genes in that class, and actually for K samples in this class and K samples in that class. And then just do your t-test or whatever. It's not dependent on the fact that you use t-test. But you do it at a level of significance that you're going to have. Now, if you did it at a very stringent level of significance, such that you have very, very few genes, false positives that are picked up, and then you try to cluster with those genes, it probably will fail. But if, with the example that I was sitting, so all I have is a simulation demonstration. It's hard to prove anything analytically about clustering, because you know, what you get is a dendrogram if you're using hierarchical clustering. So it gets into the technical difficulties of where you're cutting the dendrogram. Well, you could use two means, you know, clustering rather than. So we haven't tried to prove it. I'm sure it's true. I think that's just one of the problems with using clustering for problems where you really want to say something about different classes. That's just one of the problems. I think people have used clustering to a large extent because they've had access to software that does clustering, and some of the other methods are more statistical, and so a lot of people who are doing the analysis are not statisticians, and so they tend to stay away from it.
Also, you can use for unsupervised clustering, you can leave some like 10% data out or 20% data out to the cluster. Then will
you could, yeah, but
well,
I guess
like a k-means, right?
Yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that. You don't really want to be doing clustering at all for that problem. Okay. So we're going to spend basically the whole day on what you better methods for it. The other thing is it's just not a very powerful approach because if you're pre-selecting your genes, I mean, what you should be doing, you see, what we'll talk about when we talk about class prediction approaches is, yes, you will pre-select your genes, but then what you will do with those, you'll select your genes that are differentially expressed, but what you will do with those genes is not just cluster your data with them. You will develop a classifier with those genes. And in order to evaluate it, you will do the kind of thing you were just talking about. Well, you'll leave out a certain proportion of your samples, and you will then you will find the genes that are differentially expressed between your classes, and then you will develop a classifier, which could be a k-means kind of classifier or a nearest neighbor kind of classifier. And then you will, what will you do? You will then use that classifier to predict for the samples that you left out.
What do you mean the unsupervised k-means or theoretical classifier? If you do cross-supervised testing, it will look like the k-method if you do the unsupervised classifier, but with some kind of cross-supervised testing.
If you look, yeah, but you will have your. You mean like a k nearest neighbor class?
Yeah,
there'll be
like
a similarity.
Similar.
Okay, so I made the point that we need more than one sample of this class and more than one sample of that class, and you don't get it by You don't get that by taking only one sample of normal tissue and running five arrays on that one sample, you know, separating the RNA into five aliquots and hybridizing it on five different arrays, and then doing the same thing for your sample of disease tissue. If you do that, you know you're still only being able to make conclusions about one sample of normal tissue and one sample of disease tissue. It's just that you have some information about the variation of the assay itself, but you don't know anything about the variation of expression among normal samples or the variation of expression among disease samples. So it's just amazing how much confusion in the literature and how many methods that have been published that are really totally garbage, because they were really developed only for technical replicates and without really labeling them in that sort of way. And to make biological conclusions, you need biological replicates. And sometimes the technical replicates, meaning multiple arrays of the same specimen, sometimes that can be useful, but it's not nearly as valuable as the biological replicates for multiple specimens. And so the area gets a little bit fuzzy when we talk about what is a biological replicate if you're doing a cell line experiment. And suppose we have a cell line and we're growing it up, and then or in our contrast is we want to expose that, we want to let the cells grow in the presence of some drug, okay, in the tissue culture. And we want to compare the expression of the cells, and we harvest the cells after 10 hours or something. And we want to compare the expression profiles of the cells after 10 hours grown without intervention versus grown with this drug. Well, biological replicates means that we regrow, you know, you redo the experiment. So the technical replicates is just that you do it once without the drug, you do it once with the drug, you take multiple RNA aliquots of those cells and you make multiple arrays. Biological replicates mean you actually do the experiment more than once. You do the growing of the cells more than once under each condition.
Can I just make a comment? I think that your emphasis on prediction is the right idea, and that any of the ambiguity in what you're making inference about sort of falls away when you realize that what you would like to do is go get another patient if you're thinking translational. And that has all the uncertainty of diagnosis, of prior history, of all of this stuff. You're trying to make a prediction by looking at microarray and say something about what's going to happen to that patient. But all those sources of variation, when you go to get that patient, are there. And for example, in your laboratory cell line, you might say, repeat the experiment. Somebody says, I repeated it again. Well, that's a fact, but all of the inference about your microarray is solely directed to that single cell line that's isolated in your laboratory. So I think the emphasis on prediction is something to really keep foremost in mind throughout the whole day here. And you're going to go get something out of the real world that you've never seen before. Okay. All sorts of variability.
Okay. So class prediction is to predict which tumors will respond, for example, on a particular treatment, predict which patients will relapse after a particular treatment. Those are a couple of examples of class prediction studies. Class prediction methods usually have a gene selection as a component, but the criteria for gene selection, for class prediction, and for class comparison are somewhat different. For class comparison, where you want to know, you really want to try to understand maybe something about the mechanism of this disease or get some insight into the mechanism of the disease. And you want to find out, well, what genes are differentially expressed between this disease tissue and the normal tissue. And the reason you want to do that is because you hope the identity of those genes will tell you something about the disease. And so what you want to do, you don't want to be, if you come up with a list of 100 genes, you don't want 80 of them to be false positives, right? And so you want to be able to look at that list and say, well, these, I did this analysis in a way that most of these genes really are differentially expressed. There's not too many false positives in this list. That's really what your objective is, to come up with a list of genes and to not have too many false positives in that list. Whereas, and we'll say a little bit more about that a little bit in a few slides, for class prediction, your objective, the way I'm stating it, your objective is really to predict. And a lot of times, so predictive accuracy is really your objective. And in some cases, it will be better. The worst thing you can do for predictive accuracy is miss the genes that have a lot of predictive information in them. That's actually, in developing predictors, that's more serious than including noise genes, false positive genes in your predictor. And so when you're developing predictors, you probably are going to want to be using criteria that is less stringent. Less stringent than when you're talking about class comparison, because it turns out you'll generally wind up with better predictions that way. Now, if you have a situation where there's a relatively small number of genes and they are just hugely differentially expressed between your two classes, then you can be very stringent and you can identify those genes and get rid of all of the false positives and you know, it's a perfect situation. And that's often the situation where you're comparing really different cell types. But when you're comparing responders and non-responders or something like that, very often you don't find genes that are that differentially expressed. You find, and if you are real stringent in your class prediction, you'll get rid of most of the good genes, and your predictions will be very poor. So there, you can't make a general rule and to say, should you be stringent or should you be less stringent? But for a lot of real problems in prediction, I think. The point I'm just trying to make here is your criteria. They're two different problems, two different objectives. I've said a couple of times now that the clarity of objectives is important. I've said that many microarray studies use cluster analysis inappropriately or misleadingly. I wanted to, this first point here, that many microarray studies developing classifiers are not therapeutically relevant. What do I mean by that? I mean, suppose you really want to, prognostic factor studies in the medical literature are traditionally sort of a wasteland in the sense of there's lots of prognostic factor studies, certainly in cancer, but there's very few prognostic factors that are actually used in selecting treatments for patients. And that's because the way these studies are generally done differently than the way you would do a clinical trial. You know, you do a clinical trial, sort of logistically very complicated. But what you wind up with is you have to wind up with a bunch of patients. You're talking about a randomized clinical trial. for whom it's appropriate to compare treatment A to treatment B, and or some new treatment A to a control treatment. And what you wind up often doing with prognostic factor studies is you say, well, I want to study prognostic factors in breast cancer, and what kind of tissues do I have in my freezer, you know, or in the pathology lab. And you find you have some preserved tumor tissue from patients who had advanced stage, early stage, estrogen receptor positive tumors, estrogen receptor negative tumors. Some of them got chemotherapy, some of them didn't get chemotherapy, some of them got tamoxifen, some of them didn't get tamoxifen. And you go ahead and you have these tissues, and you go ahead and study your prognostic factors, or in this case your microarrays on those tissues, and you wind up with something that's prognostic, but it's such a hodgepodge of patients that it doesn't really tell you anything about predicting who's going to respond to any particular therapy. So it's very hard to use that information. A lot of the prognostic, you know, your results are driven by differences among your patients with regard to, you know, prognostic factors that have been known for years. And so then you have to try to figure out, well, how to disentangle those from the ones, you know, from the new ones you're studying. But basically you don't wind up with. So I'm bringing this up in a point of clarity of objectives. If your objective is to have just to go beyond saying, well, I want to know if something is prognostic. Well, okay, what do you mean? Prognostic for what kind of a set of patients? Well, if you're going to say, I want to know for women who are node negative, ER positive, receiving tamoxifen, whether I can have an expression profile that predicts who's going to recur on tamoxifen alone, then you're talking about a potentially valuable, you know, therapeutically relevant sort of study. And so when you, in fact, there was there's now a diagnostic called Oncotype DX, which is marketed by a company to do just that. And, that's an example of trying to be very specific. What do you mean by prognostic? A little bit about, just so we're all on the same page, a little bit when we talk about arrays, there's basically roughly two kinds of arrays. There's single label arrays, mostly Affymetrix gene chips, and I'm not going to go into the technology except that these are relatively high-tech arrays in which the little probes of DNA have been, these oligos have been put on silicon wafers by photolithography. And so it's pretty reproducible from slide to slide, from chip to chip. And then there's the other kind of arrays, dual label arrays, in which you basically, rather than hybridizing one specimen to the solid surface of the array, basically with the Affymetrix array, what you do is you take your RNA, your messenger RNA specimen, you label it with a fluorescent label, and you hybridize it onto this array, and I'll skip a lot of the details. With the dual label arrays, is you actually take two specimens. One, you have specimen A, and you label it with some fluorescent label, and you take specimen B, you the RNA from specimen B and you use a different fluorescent label to label the RNA, and then you mix them together and you splash them down on essentially a microscope slide that has little pieces of DNA that have been printed on that microscope slide. And usually with the dual label array, you're using something like a logarithm of the ratio of intensity at each spot. Now, I think there's been a lot. It's pretty straightforward with the single label arrays. With the dual label arrays, it gets more complicated because then what are you going to? Well, how do you decide what two things? In other words, if you want to compare Tumor to normal, there's a lot of things you could do. You could, on each array, you could co-hybridize a tumor in a, you know, a RNA from a tumor and RNA from normal tissue, or you could co-hybridize RNA from a tumor versus some common reference, a mixture of cell lines, say, and use the RNA from that common reference, just multiple aliquots of that, as sort of your common reference, as shown here. So suppose we have disease tissue A, normal tissue B, and then we have some common reference RNA from, say, some mixture of human cell lines. And so this is the common reference design. In which on some of the arrays we put, on all of the arrays we have the common reference labeled in, with the same label, but on some of the arrays we have the disease tissue, and in other of the arrays we have samples of the normal tissue. And so this is the common reference design. And if we're talking about prediction, and if we're using dual label arrays, then this is basically the design we should be using. If we're talking about class comparison, if we want to find differentially expressed genes, then it can be better to use other kind of designs, like this paired design where you have, you don't use a common reference at all, but on each array you put one sample from your disease tissue and the other sample from your normal tissue, or one sample from your responders and the other sample from your non-responders, or whatever your classes are. If you're really just into gene finding, then some of these other designs like that can be... I think I had an example of another design, but it looks like it's further along, can be more efficient, can get you by with fewer arrays. But if you're interested in prediction models, class prediction with dual label arrays, because what are you going to do in the future? In the future, you've got some new patient, so you're trying to predict who's going to respond to a therapy, and you're going to do it based on the expression data. And so you're going to have to measure it in some way. And so what are you going to do? Are you going to, you can't match it up against a response. You know, so you've got a sample from a new patient, and what are you going to co-hybridize it with? A sample from, well, if you did in your studies with responders versus non-responders, and that's sort of, you developed your predictor based on that, there's sort of no way, you don't know at the time when you're doing your prediction for this new patient whether they're a responder or non-responder. So you can't do that. So you have to, if you're talking about prediction and it's a dual label array, you should be using this common reference design. The reference generally serves to control variation in the size of corresponding spots on different arrays and variation in sample distribution over the slide. The question is, well, why do you use dual label arrays? Why does Affymetrix have single labels and these other arrays based mostly on lower tech microscope slides, why do they use dual labels? Well, there's two critical differences between the Affymetrix tech arrays and the printed arrays. One is the Affymetrix technology tends to get, if you look at the size of the amount of oligo at a corresponding to a particular probe on two chips, they'll be pretty uniform. But if you look at two printed slides that have been robotically printed, there'll be a lot of variation in how much DNA got spotted down on this slide compared to exactly the same corresponding spot on the next slide. And so that means if you just try to compare the intensity on slide 2 to the intensity on slide 1, there's going to be a lot of variation. Even if you, in fact, here's an example of it. This was a, I took this from the literature, where they basically spotted, they printed the same DNA in hundreds of times on this slide. This is on one slide. This is not two slides. This is just on one slide. And they made a bunch of spots of exactly the same cDNA. And then they took two RNA from two cell types, and they labeled them and co-hybridized them on that slide. And what they found is, for each of the cell types, they had a great, and each point here corresponds to a different spot on this slide, but the spots are all the same, supposed to be the same DNA. So they had a tremendous variation in the intensity they got at these different spots, the intensity in both of these channels. The relationship between those two, the ratio of the intensities of the two fluorescent dyes were pretty much constant. That's why we're getting a straight line here. But the intensities of each dye themselves. And there's two reasons. One is because the size of the spots are not well controlled when they're printed. And the second reason is when you splash the sample down on the face of a microscope slide and then just put the cover slip down, you don't have a uniform distribution of your sample across the face of the slide. And if you do it on this slide and then you do it again on that slide, the distribution on this slide is not the same as the distribution on this slide. Whereas with Affymetrix gene chips, the sample is circulated through the chip, and so you have a uniform distribution of sample. So because of those two technical factors, with Affymetrix gene chips, they don't need to use a relative measure of an intensity. Things are pretty much reproducible enough from chip to chip that you can directly compare intensity on one chip to intensity on another chip. That's not true with printed slides. Now, there's a lot of, you know, more recent technology with printed slides, so whether that's true with some of the recent Agilent stuff, I don't know. But in general, but what is more constant is if you take the ratio of the intensity of your two samples at the same spot, that they'll both be affected by the size of, both of those intensities will be affected by the size of that spot and by how much, what the concentration of the mixture was above that spot. And so that ratio will pretty much be the same from spot to spot. and slide. Well, and slide
the Affymetrix one, then that's just like a single label, then you just have to write down some threshold and say, well, if I see the label at this concentration or above, then I say, well, I've got some hybridization.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of the analysis you do, you just use the quantitative intensity measurement.
The variation from slide to slide is sufficiently small that you can write down a threshold that you can use across slides.
Well, like I said, and sometimes it's not even a threshold as to whether it's above or below the threshold, but you can. There is a normalization there is a normalization. Even with the Affymetrix, that's done across slides, and so I'm not recommending not doing the normalization. But it's that normalization is really affecting what you're not controlling is the constant. In other words, there's other things that can affect things slide to slide, but it's affecting it slide to slide. Things like what was your concentration of your whole sample that you put down on the chip, and what did you change the machine settings and things like that, and so once you sort of normalize for those chip wide differences, then it should be reproducible. Whereas for the others, for the two color arrays, usually what you do is you don't normalize inter-chip, inter-slide, you just sort of normalize the red intensity versus the green intensity on each slide.
Interestingly enough, the data set from the camera based here, the CFS data set, the microarray one, it's a single color array, but it's a printed array. I don't know how that is possible. Having careful analyze the data, I just simply plot something like this, a scatter plot. I don't know how can I deal with it, but I'm interested to find out how.
Unless it's some really recent kind of high-tech array that's much more reproducible, that's just a really bad idea.
Actually, it's not the audio array. It's a regular, I believe it's a regular CD-ring kind of array, but it's single color.
Motorola is 60 more like the 60 more. Okay. Yeah, so they still oligo for 60.
That's what I'm saying. There are some more recent high-tech ways that probably give better reproducibility and may not require. I think I'm going to have to speed up here a little bit because this was just going to be introductory material. For two color microarrays, each sample of interest should be labeled once. This is about dye swapping. When we're talking about, we're going to be talking mostly about class prediction, and for class prediction, you don't really need to be doing any dye swapping. I think I'm going to skip some of this stuff on dye bias. There are designs when you're interested in class comparison, gene finding. What you can do if you use a design such that on each array you hybridize a sample of say disease tissue and a sample of normal tissue. Suppose you're not interested in prediction and you're just interested in gene finding, and the way you do each array is you have a sample from each of your classes. It's a problem if you class A is always given one fluorescent label and class B is always given the other fluorescent label, because there'll be a confounding between differences between the labels and differences between the classes, and you try to remove some of that in the normalization process, but you don't remove sort of gene-specific dye bias. in normalization process on dual label arrays, you sort of just remove average dye bias. And so there's sort of two approaches to it. Either one is, one of the approaches is you always do a dye swap. If you're going to do a particular diseased tissue versus normal tissue on one array and you label one red, the other green, then you have another array in which you use exactly the same RNAs from those, but you reverse the label. And that's called a dye bias. And there's this great misconception in the field that you should always do everything with dye swaps. It's actually a very inefficient sort of way of doing your experiments, even if you're interested in gene finding. A better way to do it is like these balanced block designs, where some of your slides you do diseased tissue labeled with red and normal tissue labeled with green. You don't do a dye swap of those particular RNA samples, but on other slides you just do it reversed. And then basically you can do an analysis of variance, kind of an analysis. And I mean, the dye swap is okay, but it uses a lot more arrays than this does. Yes?
Can you track the variance within the group, so the variance within class A, with this block design?
Typically
you say you look at the log of the ratio between A and B.
Yeah, here you wouldn't, what you would normally do is not just look at the log ratio. You would actually have an analysis of variance of the log intensity. And we have that kind of a thing in BRB array tools, for example. And as your descriptive factors, you have a class and label, and you can, and you don't actually, and so this is the idea here is, you've never done any technical replicates at all. You don't see an A1 labeled green and a B1 labeled red. So the idea here is you're only using none of these are technical replicates. It's just you're putting the different switching the labels. And I mean, the alternative approach is to do, you can do dye swaps on some of your experiments and then do an analysis of variance. And when you do it on the log intensity from the ones where you've done the dye swaps, you will be able to estimate these kinds of which genes have the gene-specific dye bias. There's a couple of papers in the reference list by Kevin Dobbin and myself, and that sort of goes into this in great detail in comparing the different designs. But this generally is much more efficient than doing dye swaps of everything. And for class prediction, of course, you don't want to be doing any of these things. You just want to be doing labeling, using a common reference and labeling it the same color on everything. Yeah, this is the detailed comparison of the effectiveness of these designs. Common reference designs are effective for many microarray studies. They're both robust, permit comparisons among separate experiments, permit many type of comparisons. For simple two-class comparison problems, balanced block designs require many fewer arrays than common reference designs. Loop designs, which have been pushed very much, the loop design, they were really developed in the context of cell line studies with no biological replication. And but with one sample from a bunch of different cell lines, more than two usually, and where you want to make all these comparisons, but you don't actually have biological replicates. And a lot of claims were made for them. For the most part, those claims are right if you're doing no biological replication. But for more realistic problems, I think most of those claims are wrong. Okay. Some of the things I was not planning on discussing today: image analysis, normalization methods, clustering methods. I will say a little bit about class comparison, because I think I wasn't actually planning to, but I think it wasn't real clear from the title of the talk that I wasn't going to be talking much about class comparison, and so I think I added a few slides about it, so we will talk a little bit about that. And in fact, I'll talk a little bit about class comparison right now, and then the rest of it will be more class prediction. So the idea, class comparison, the simple approach is each gene, so you want to find the genes that are differentially expressed between class A and class B. And you want, basically the name of the game is to try to do this and to try to control your, in some sense, your false number of false positives. The simplest approach is just to test each gene at some significance level alpha. Like, and there's a variety of tests you could use. You could use t-tests. You could use, if you have two classes, you could use Wilcoxon test. And let's assume that you're going to do each test at some level alpha, significance threshold, for claiming that that gene is differentially expressed. That will be your cutoff significance threshold alpha. And let's suppose there are k genes, and k could be something like 10,000 or 20,000. Well, if that's the case, then the expected number of false positives or false discoveries is k times alpha. And if you want to limit that, then basically what you have to do is make the alpha very small. So if you wanted to say, well, I really don't want more than one false positive expected, then it would mean, well, okay, alpha should be 1 divided by 10,000 if I have 10,000 genes. Limiting it to 1 is pretty stringent. However, in sort of other situations, like we're doing fewer comparisons, the traditional kind of multiple testing control to use is this Bonferroni kind of control, and that's even much more stringent, because that's essentially saying, I want to be 95% sure that I'm making no false positives, that I'm coming up with no false positives. Well, that's too conservative for microarray studies, because that may be appropriate for like a clinical trial where we have 3 primary endpoints, and we really want, if we get positive results, that our treatment is better than control, we want to make some really strong claims about it and maybe have our drug approved. Then we really want to be sure that we're not, have strong evidence that we're not making any false claims. But for a microarray study where it's a different context, we don't really want to be that stringent, because being that stringent, 1 is not really appropriate, and 2, it will really reduce the number of genes that we wind up claiming looking differentially expressed. So, bless you. So the sort of what's I think pretty widely accepted now is a more appropriate sort of criteria for controlling false positives with microarray kind of studies, and is sort of something what's been called the false discovery rate. Something like if you're going to wind up with 100 genes and that you claim these look like the ones that are differentially expressed, you don't want too great a proportion of that 100 to be false positives. You know, it's probably okay to have 5 or 10% of those to be false positives. So out of 100 genes that you claim, so your false discovery rate is the expected proportion of false positives among the genes that you claim to be differentially expressed. And I think the term was originally coined by Benjamini and Hochberg in a 1995 paper. And since then, there's a lot of statistical methods that have been devised to do multiple testing while trying to control false discovery rate. We're not really going to spend the time to go into these different methods, but I did want to introduce this concept because this is probably the relevant concept. So even if you it's sort of the reason you can get by with, you had raised a question earlier, well, if you have 20,000 genes you're looking at, how can you, you know, wouldn't you need a huge number of patients to start sort of screening those genes for which ones would be differentially expressed between diseased tissue and normal tissue? Well, whether you would need a huge number or not depends on what kind of control you want on false positives. If you really wanted to say, well, I don't want to have any false positive claims, or I want to use something like a Bonferroni correction for multiple testing, and then if you did a power calculation with that very stringent criteria for claiming a gene was differentially expressed, you probably would find that you needed a huge sample size, number of cases, to have good power of finding the truly differentially expressed genes. But if you're less stringent, if you're willing to say, well, I'm willing to have 10% of my claims be false positives, then that's a much less stringent criteria than the Bonferroni criteria, and your sample size actually will be much less than that. And in fact, your sample size, we'll get into sample, if we have time, I have some slides with sample size formulas, and there's towards the end, and you'll see the sample size requirements. They, of course, depend on how differentially expressed the genes would be between the two different tissues, and they also depend upon the variability within the normals and within the diseased tissues, but your sample sizes are actually surprisingly small. So just to sort of show it, so you have true null hypotheses, that is for genes that are not differentially expressed, and then you have genes that really are differentially expressed. And then that's along the side here. I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer here. And along the top, we're giving the results of our analysis. So of the ones we reject, that column marked rejected, those 100 genes are the genes that we claim these genes look differentially expressed between our classes. And in the situation, the way we've set it up here, we have 10 of those 100 are false positives, and so we have a false discovery rate of 10%. And we've analyzed 1,000 genes. I think I'm going to skip this detailed stuff about how to do the Benjamini and Hochberg test. It's actually very simple. And then there are more complicated tests like SAM and multivariate permutation test, which also sort of basically try to control things like the false discovery rate. SAM tries to control the expected false discovery rate, and these multivariate permutation tests really try to give you sort of trying to control either the number of false discoveries or the false discovery rate with a specified confidence. Let me just finish a sentence. And they are not sort of applying it one at a time to each gene. And so they try to take into account the correlations among the genes and basically that and to try to be more powerful for controlling false discovery. The other thing about they are also permutation tests, so they are not dependent upon normal distribution approximations. Now, in some cases, they may use as test statistics t-statistics, but they're not really doing t-tests because they're just using those as measures of differences between the classes with regard to that gene, and then they're then doing permutations based on those statistics. So both SAM and the multivariate permutation tests, they are permutation tests, and they're not dependent upon normal approximations. T-tests, of course, are dependent upon normal approximations. And you could say, well, I don't have to use t-tests. Couldn't I just use, like, regular old Wilcoxon test, one gene at a time? That actually doesn't work too well, unless you have large sample sizes, because the reason is, if you have large sample sizes, you probably don't need to be using things like Wilcoxon tests, because t-tests, as you have a larger number of cases, the central limit theorem applies, and you wind up with normal distribution being good approximations to the... The problem with the things like the Wilcoxon test is that if you're doing things one gene at a time, you have to, in order to control your number of false positives, you have to be very stringent with your alpha level you consider differentially expressed. And with univariate rank tests like Wilcoxon tests, nothing will be significant if you try to be real stringent. There's just not enough possible permutations to achieve a stringent, like 0.001 or more stringent significance level. So if you have relatively small number of cases, using univariate rank tests just doesn't work. T-tests are not that bad. The only problem being, again, we're talking about very stringent alpha levels, and to get your normal approximation working, it comes in much faster towards the center of the distribution than it does way, way out in the tail, like at the 0.001 tail level. So you do always have this question about how accurate is the normal approximation that far out in the tail. And so there are real advantages of things like SAM or these multivariate permutation tests. Yes?
Yes, I read a lot of paper about performing power analysis for class comparison type test. How about power analysis for class prediction? Is there such thing?
We have a new paper by Kevin Dobbin and I. That's really the first paper on sample size planning for class prediction analysis. And it's been accepted for publication in Biostatistics. And I believe it's on, I think the preprint is on our website now in the technical reports section. And I'm going to show you results from that. That's, I think, one of the last things we'll do this afternoon. Yeah.
There was a guy comes to me and says he wants to use microarray to prove that two cell lines has no difference. This seems a very strange case to me, and he wants to calculate what is the sample size need to do for microarrays. The first thing is microarray appropriate to make those kind of conclusions? And the second thing is, if so, how about the sample size?
Okay, we're going to, again, the last thing I have is both is sample size both for class comparison and sample size for class prediction. They're very different. I have slides for both of them. They're sort of at the last things I have on the agenda today. And we'll get to those. And there was another paper by Kevin Dobbin and I on sample size for class comparison that was published in Biostatistics. And I think that's on the technical reports website. And it's, on, I think, listed. In one of the slides here, I list both of those citations. I would think for that problem, yes, what you would do is you'd say, well, okay, it's a class comparison. I want to plan it in such a way that I control something like my false discovery rate from the analysis to by a certain amount, and I want to have sufficient power to have, say, 80 or 90% probability of detecting a gene that whose average difference between the two classes is, say, a twofold difference. And so you can only answer that question, you know, how do I show that there are no differences? Well, the way you normally, I think, plan that is you would plan it from a traditional power calculation standpoint to have adequate power to detect a difference of a certain size. Now, at the end, once you've got the data, you could just calculate for each gene a confidence interval for the difference, in expression level between those two cell lines. But you could. I think microarrays would be appropriate. And actually, the sample size calculation which we've published, we've done it relatively simply, and we'll get to it. Whereas we develop it, say you're going to do it at a particular alpha level, and we say, well, if you have 20,000 genes on the array and you really want your false discovery rate to be 10%, then your alpha level should be, you can figure out, there is a relationship between alpha level and false discovery rate. It does actually depend on what proportion of the genes you believe are actually truly differentially expressed. But anyway, so then you can get a sample size from it. And then the problem in a situation like that, though, would be if he's got two cell lines, you could do it one of two ways, either just with technical replicates of one growth of this two cell lines or actual replicates by regrowing the cell lines. So to do what he wants to do, really properly statistically, may require more replicates than what he thinks. Okay, we have about, I think we'll go for about 25 more minutes and then we'll eat lunch. I am going to skip the details of these multi-mutation tests.
All these slides will be in your PowerPoint.
How many?
No, all these slides will be in your PowerPoint.
Yeah. Except those last couple. I'll put these. Those last couple were not on your handout.
Yeah, they were in the
because
PowerPoint.
I put them in at the end, but they will be on the PowerPoint file. Everything else from here on out will be in your handout. I didn't add any slides. Okay, so now we're going to move into class prediction. So the idea of class prediction is given a sample with an expression profile vector X. Now, by that I just mean the first component of that is just the level of intensity, if we're talking about gene chips, a level of intensity of gene 1 in the on the array for that patient specimen. X2 is a level of intensity for gene 2, and we go out for all 30,000 genes. And I'm just using that as sort of the expression profile vector. Either intensities or log ratios if we have two dual label arrays, what we have are the ratio of the expression for the sample of the patient to the common reference, which we've used for cohybridization on each of the slides. And so we're just measuring, there's nothing, all we're doing is it means we're measuring expression of the samples we really care about relative to this common reference expression. And then we want to predict which class the sample belongs to. And so the class prediction model, this is a very mathematical statement of it. Usually when I present things, I get rid of all of the mathematical jargon, and then the statisticians in the audience feel really cheated, because there's a rule that if you can understand what somebody has said, must not have been very, what they said must not have been very important or very deep. I personally think it's sort of just the opposite, that notation tends to mask a lot of times the lack of depth. So I generally try to get rid of all notation. But here I'm trying to present it a little bit with a little notation. So the class prediction model is actually some function which maps a set of vectors to the set of class labels, one or two. So we're thinking of those two classes, and when we talk about, say, normal versus disease, here I'm thinking of, we might label the normal as class one and the disease as class two. And then this function F, this classifier, generally is probably only going to use some of the genes that we've measured. And part of the game of trying to develop a classifier is to figure out, well, which genes should I be using? Which genes are informative for this kind of prediction? And so specifying the model involves specifying which genes to use, specifying maybe some parameters to use, and also probably specifying the form of function we're going to use. We'll get into this very shortly. Well, many diagnostic or prognostic marker studies, some of them are not reproducible. For a variety of reasons, it's hard to be, when you do any kind of develop a prognostic model, you're dealing with some set of samples. And we may get into, and so we may try to sort of split the samples into two groups for developing our classifier and predicting. But it's still one group of samples, and we may have done all of our assays in one laboratory at one short point in time, and it's different than reproducing a whole study with samples coming from different patients, assayed in a different laboratory. And so there are reasons why studies tend not to be reproducible, even though if we do our analysis properly, we will try to evaluate at least internally how good our classifier is, at least by trying to avoid this trap of using completely the same data for developing the classifier and evaluating it. And also a lot of traditional prognostic studies are not very focused, and there's multiplicity problems that are not handled properly. And other ones are not really have no impact for the most part because they don't address therapeutically relevant questions. So the components of class prediction, as I said, are gene selection, selecting some model type, and we're going to talk about a bunch of different model classifier types, and then fitting parameters. Those are the components of developing a classifier, a class predictor. And then there's also going to be a way, we're going to talk about how do you evaluate the predictive accuracy of a classifier. And the statistical methods appropriate for class prediction, as I've mentioned, are somewhat different than for class comparison. Demonstrating statistical significance of prognostic factors is not the same as demonstrating predictive accuracy. With class prediction, the focus should be on prediction, not really statistical significance. How well does our classifier predict? Demonstrating goodness of fit of a model to the data used to develop it is not really a demonstration of predictive accuracy. Traditionally in statistics, we deal with problems where we have a model with very small number of parameters, or we have a small number of candidate prognostic factors, and we have a large number of cases. And we fit some kind of a model, a Cox proportional hazards model, and then we evaluate the goodness of fit of that model to our data. And we don't really try to separate the data used for developing the model from the data used for testing the model. We think of this goodness of fit as sort of a measure of how if the model then fits the data, we think somehow that model should work for the future. The only reason we can get by with that at all is because we have been dealing with problems that have a small number of candidate predictors, a small number of parameters, and a large relative to a large number of cases. Once you get out of that context, like with microarrays, you're sort of in the opposite. Instead of having 5 or 10 candidate predictors in 100 cases, you may have 25 or 50 cases and 30,000 candidate predictors, being the 30,000 gene expression levels. So you totally switched the ratio of cases to candidate predictors. And it actually doesn't work. I mean, I've seen innumerable machine learning people say, well, yeah, but I'm going to only look at models that have three predictors in them. Well, yeah, but you've selected those three predictors to give the optimal prediction after screening 30,000 candidate predictors. So essentially, you have 30,000 variables. You just happen to using a model that has 29,900 you know, most of them have zeros, and then you have three of those genes. But you've used your data to screen all of these genes. So the fact that your selected models may have very few predictors in them doesn't really, you're still in the situation where you, it's just really ripe for overfitting your data, for developing a model that looks like it fits your data really well, and is totally useless for predicting for the future. So these kind of problems, goodness of fit doesn't actually mean anything. And so statisticians are used to inference problems, not prediction, and we just have to keep reminding ourselves that these are actually prediction problems. And most statistical methods were not developed for this P much greater than N, where P sort of denotes the number of candidate predictors and N is the number of cases. Now, the simplest way of selecting genes for our predictor is to select genes that univariately, one at a time, seem to be differentially expressed between the classes. And so what some people do is they say, well, I'm going to select, I've got 30,000 genes here, I'm going to select the 10 genes that are most differentially expressed between these two classes that I'm trying to develop a predictor for. Or you could say, well, I'm going to select all of the genes that are, I'm going to do some kind of a significance test, like a t-test between these classes, and I'm going to include in my predictor all of the genes that are significant at some 0.01. level, or whatever level you pick. Unfortunately, you don't really know what level to pick, but if you select a level, if you select a number of genes to pick, that's the most common way of selecting the genes. Now, the alpha level is really just selected to control the number of genes in the model. I mean, if this were a class comparison situation, we would have more guidance on what we wanted to do for alpha. We would say, well, we want to control somehow the false discovery rate, the proportion of them that are false positives. And we could still do that here, and that would still be reasonable to do. But like I said, sometimes it's better to be not quite as stringent as you would. For class comparison problems, my favorite alpha is 0.001. And now, of course, I use multivariate permutation tests, but it's surprising at how well 0.001 works for class comparison.
So 0.001 without the multi-test correction?
I'm sorry?
You mean?
Yeah, without it, yeah.
And also for the feature selection, you can also use the cross-validation to optimize the level of genes, right?
Yeah, we'll get into that. The problem with that is, as we'll talk about, there are two uses for things like cross-validation. There's a cross-validation for estimating the predictive accuracy of a model, and then there's cross-validation for optimizing a tuning parameter, like the alpha. And I would say 95% of the people who use cross-validation for optimizing the tuning parameter forget that they confuse that and think that they're also using it. They use it, they don't nest one within the other. And so they wind up with sort of a biased result. But we'll talk about that nesting later. So you could do a t-test for comparing, for each gene, comparing the expression level of that gene in class 1 and the expression in class 2. And we won't go into the real, you know, when you do a t-test, then there's the issue of, well, you're going to estimate the variance separately for each gene, or are you going to assume all the genes have the same variance, or are you going to use, there's a couple of ways of having, not assuming that the different genes have the same variance, but sharing, assuming that there's a distribution of variance values among the genes, and having what's called a hierarchical model to share that information among genes. And George Wright, one of the people in my group, and I published a paper cited there that shows how to do that. And that's, we call that the random variance model. And there's also a Bayesian version of that same thing. And it's a nice way of sharing information among genes. It actually gives you somewhat more powerful t-tests without making strong and incorrect assumptions like all of the genes have the same variance. A lot of the analysis of variance, things that you see make the assumption that all genes have the same variance. But if you do an analysis of variance separately for each gene, it doesn't make that assumption, but it also doesn't share information among the genes. There are also a variety of methods that have been published that claim to have more powerful ways of gene selection, or feature selection, than just doing univariate tests for each gene. And ways of trying to select small subsets of genes which together give the better predictions. Some of these methods use things like genetic algorithms, which is just a combinatorial optimization algorithm. Others use much simpler kinds of things. There was one published by Bo that uses a simple kind of step, looks for gene pairs. There's a more recent paper by what's his name at Johns Hopkins, who calls it top-scoring pairs method, and sort of searches for gene pairs. We have that implemented in BRBRA tools. My take on it is that most of these methods I have not seen any real much evidence that these complex feature selection methods do any better than the simple one gene at a time feature selection. And many of them have one of two problems. Either they evaluate the complicated method, say with genetic algorithm, and they show that for a given problem they get good results, but they don't compare it to simpler methods. Or they evaluate the complex method in a way that is invalid because they don't cross-validate the results properly. They sort of use all of the data to select the genes and then just cross-validate the fitting of the model parameters. And so the whole thing is really a biased evaluation of the method. So I think it's important. It would be really nice to have a method that came up with permitted you to find a small number of genes that classified together well and gave you as good a results. Wouldn't even have to be better results than classifiers based on larger number of genes. But for the most part, I don't see it happening. We did implement in BRBRA tools this top scoring pair algorithm, and because I thought it looked pretty good, and the statisticians who had developed it, I thought, had pretty good reputations. And so far, when I've applied it to data, one of the nice things about BRBRA tools is that you can actually try these different methods on your own data and see whether any of them do any better than any other ones. And so far, this top scoring pair, usually what I find is that the methods all do about the same. There is an exception with the top scoring pair. It seems to do considerably worse than the other methods, although so far we've only implemented it for the single top scoring pair, and maybe that's the problem. And with the next release of BRBRA tools, which should be out by July 1st, we'll select multiple, more than one just top scoring pair.
Yeah, but this problem is like when you select feature, they are unrelated to your model you want to use, right?
Pardon?
You select feature first, then you apply model. Right?
Usually you select your feature and then you fit the model to those features.
So like the recursive feature elimination for the SVM, that is like combine both.
Yeah, but so a lot of these methods I'm talking about are combined. They don't, none of them seem to really, most of them are evaluated invalidly.
Did you try the SVM IV?
I haven't tried all of the methods, but I've looked, you know, when I see a method published, I read it, and most of the time I don't have to go any further than that because their claims are based on an invalid cross-validation. But I haven't tried that one. I think there's good reason to believe that most of those methods will not work, and that is it's because you don't have enough data to use complicated methods. Trying to find features that work well together in one way or another is essentially looking for interactions in your data. And when your number of features is orders of magnitude more than your number of cases, you are really overfitting your data if you then start looking at combinations of those features. And so I think, at least to me, except in situations where maybe there probably are some situations where the interactions are so strong that they will stand out compared to the apparent interactions that are really just from the results of having large number of features. But in the other situations, you will come up with interactions, but they really will not be real. And unless you evaluate the method properly, you'll think you have something, but you really won't. So, again, I'm not saying it would never work, but I would be saying that for many problems, or maybe most of the problems, I would not expect you, unless the interactions are really super strong, I would not expect you.
For SVM, instead of trying all combination of genes, you try, like, use SVM, build a model, and based on the contribution, each gene's contribution to the model, to eliminate those.
Yeah, no, I know. I all I'm saying is everybody has their favorite method.
Yeah.
And none of these methods were actually developed for situations where the number of features is orders of magnitude more than the number of cases. If you look at the SVM theory, I've read Viapnik's book, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that that would really work for this kind of a problem. We've used linear SVMs. It's in BRB array tools without feature recursive feature elimination, and it does about as well as everything else, no better.
We found it a little bit better than regular
SVM. Oh, well, maybe so, yeah. No, I'm saying I haven't tried with recursive feature elimination. I think this might be a good time to stop, because now we're going to getting into a batch of stuff that I think would be better to look at together.
So we have a variety of guest blocks on this back here. There's some vegetarian sandwiches as well as other non-vegetarian drinks. Again, the bathrooms are to the left down the hall on your left, and there's a break room right across if you guys get a soda.
I have seen another paper where they talked about recursive elimination in SVM and did also claim that it did work better.
You should not try the hook, because you should not try 20,000 genes at first. Maybe you should pre-filtering some genes. But at the end, because each time you use SVM to select genes, then you remove these significant genes based on the SVM model contribution, like the weighting.
Yeah.
So that is like the model relevant. So you remove those genes which is least significant. And remove the number.
So you're saying you've tried that?
Yeah, we tried that. We tried that. We used all kind of model. That model is like the not all the cases.
And then
the
how do you evaluate it? How have you evaluated it? Its performance?
Oh, we just based on cross validation.
So you do that within each training set?
Yes. So first set the 10% or 20% data, then do the SVM build model, SVM recursive build this model.
Okay.
Then we
have you published that? Because I would like to.
They have the paper. We not publish, which I use that method.
Huh?
They have method available. The method we just
available.
S plus or R, they have available. So
okay.
We just use that methods. And I have two questions.
And and you compared it to not doing the recursive anymore.
Yeah, you just select based on the t-test of like all kind of the univariate method. And
uh-huh.
At least use the univariate method, you should remove those genes with highly correlated genes. Essentially, you select the most significant genes, then try to remove those genes highly correlated. Because we have experience, if you select only based on t-test, the top 100 genes, maybe a lot of genes are highly redundant.
Yeah, right.
Maybe those genes should be removed to highly correlated genes.
Here's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of motivations for why something should work. But in a situation where P is much greater than M, and a lot of times trying to do what seems reasonable actually makes it worse.
Yeah, actually, I
like it's linear discriminant analysis versus diagonal linear discriminant analysis. Linear discriminant analysis should work better because it takes the correlations into account. But the problem is, if you try to estimate all of those correlations.
Yeah.
And use them, that most of your estimates are bad. And so
actually, try to remove those highly correlated genes it try to reduce the overfitting problem because
yes.
of those genes.
I'd be actually interested so in trying the because I've seen other things suggesting that SCM with recursive elimination is good, so I think it is something I'll try.
Okay. I have two questions actually. One question is that for the, this model prediction, usually you have a log regression, right?
Log to right, yeah.
So sometimes you need a normalized control. Normalized to control together. Say if I have control samples, then you have a different treatment, right? Different, same patient, right?
If you have two color arrays.
No, not one color array. You're
talking about one color
array. One color array. Still, you have control, right? You have the patient before treatment and after treatment, right? You based on the after treatment there.
Wait, so you're comparing before to after?
No, because you have treatment and placebo, right?
Okay.
But treatment, you have 6 hours or 0 hours before treatment and after treatment.
Okay, that's your study?
Yeah, placebo also 6 hours.
I got
you. So each patient, so you want to remove those patient variation, you want to normalize 6 hours to 0 hours. To remove, to just like that.
Wait. You have treatment, you have control.
You have placebo, right?
Placebo.
Each
and what
treatment.
Are you, is this a prediction problem?
You have the treatment, you have a prediction. You try to see.
What are you trying to predict?
After you have data after the treatment, after 6 hours.
I understand what you have. Yeah, what are you trying to predict?
Predict which one is
So you got to be very clear as to what you're trying to predict.
So
maybe, this is a prediction.
Okay. So there's a lot of people. The treatment, you have treatment. You have a response and a long response, right?
Okay.
Both are treatment.
Responders and non-responders.
And
for both of them, you have
6 hours.
If you're trying to predict who will respond,
you want to predict who will respond.
So what do you want to predict?
We'll predict after. Yeah, we want to predict after 6 hours treatment. We want to predict who will be respond.
Why? That makes no sense. No.
It is not for patient. It's for like for some kind of the study like the. Some treatment study once, because otherwise you
want. I don't think that's actually a prediction.
No, it's a toxic study. Otherwise,
yeah.
You want.
What I'm saying is, I think that's a comparison study.
No, you will treat, say, for this, okay, not response, because too many. So this is a toxic and a non toxic, right?
Yeah.
So you want to predict which compound treatment was toxic, which compound is non toxic. Instead of waiting for 30 days to see the physiological change, you want to buy some marker array to see whether 6 hours you will see some interesting change, right?
Okay.
6 hours you can predict. So, but it's better to normalize 6 hours because you can remove some variation.
So
right?
You want
to
remove
some variation, then based on this intensity to the model, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I see
yeah. So this is a this.
So you want to normalize it
to 0 hours. Yeah. For each
so
item.
You could do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could do
but sometimes so this is a log ratio. So say 1 is 4, 1 is 1, right? You should like just 1 4 divided by 1 equal to 4.
Using the log.
Yeah.
And then you subtract off.
Subtract. So you should subtract instead of divided by.
Okay. What's the 4 and what's the? Oh, this is a single label array.
Yeah, single level array. So this is the 4, this is the 1. 6 hour, 4
should
is
be,
3
see,
or 4.
Normally we do log with, so we would do the log of 4.
Minus 1.
Minus the log of 4.
Minus, okay, yeah. So
normally we would build these predictive models based on the log of the intensity.
Yeah.
If you
normalize, so it should be subtracted 1.
Yeah.
And also like that.
Although, you know, the log of the ratio is the same as the difference of the logs.
Yeah. And what apply the...
Oh, we get some more. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the efficient effect on T-test?
I wanted to do a full show of the people who are now in the summer. So they have some Yeah. Yeah, you have to move between Beta genes, beta, so look genes, you know this is like how highly